it is Tuesday, May 5th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. A fire broke out on a South Korean cargo ship stranded in the Strait of Hormuz after an explosion. President Trump says the vessel was attacked by Iran. More on that in news briefing. On In Depth, we'll look at how AI is affecting jobs in South Korea and abroad as the nation's unemployment topped 1 million in the first quarter and youth unemployment hit a five-year high. We'll mark Children's Day by looking at how the war in the Middle East is affecting children's safety, health, education and rights. And on Hallyu Highlights, we'll talk a packed May comeback calendar for K-pop girl groups and a trainee-level ban. Let's start Korea 24 right now. A fire broke out on a South Korean cargo ship stranded in the Strait of Hormuz following an explosion. Fortunately, the crew aboard the ship is safe and no casualties have been reported. The government said it's working to determine what happened to the ship, including whether it may have been struck in an attack. For more on this and other headlines of the day, Rosine Park from the KBS World Radio News Desk joins us now. Hello, Rosine.
Hello, Alana.
Rosine, the foreign ministry in Seoul said the explosion aboard the ship, the HMM Namu, occurred at around 8:40 p.m. Monday, Korea Standard Time. Can you give us more details?
Sure. So that explosion was followed by a fire that reportedly broke out in the port side engine room of the ship, which was fortunately extinguished by crew members about 4 hours later. And as you mentioned, thankfully, no casualties were reported. But of course, the ship took on damage. We do know that 6 South Koreans and 18 foreign nationals were on board at the time of the incident.
Do we know where exactly the ship was located at the time?
Yeah, we do. The cargo ship, which is a Panamanian-flagged vessel operated by South Korea's Hyundai Merchant Marine, it was anchored outside port limits of the United Arab Emirates Umm Al Quwain in the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran has effectively closed since the war began 2 months ago.
And do we know what's going to happen next to this ship?
Well, officials said the ship will be towed to the port of Dubai for investigations to determine the cause of the explosion, and including whether the ship was attacked. Now, this incident comes as tensions have reignited in the area once again following the U.S. announcement of Project Freedom, which is an operation aimed at freeing the many stranded ships in the critical waterway. According to Iranian state media on Monday, a ranking Iranian military commander warned that all commercial vessels and oil tankers, they should refrain from any attempt to transit without coordination. Meanwhile, Seoul will be continuing to monitor the 26 South Korean vessels currently stuck in the strait, including the 123 South Korean crew aboard those ships, as well as 37 other South Korean sailors who are said to be on a foreign flagship in the area.
Well, let's now go back to the suspicions that this was a possible attack on that South Korean ship. U.S. President Donald Trump seemed to be pointing the finger at Iran.
Yes, he did. In a social media post on Monday, Trump said Iran has taken some shots at unrelated nations with respect to the ship movement, which he calls Project Freedom, including a South Korean cargo ship. He added that perhaps it's time for South Korea to come and join the U.S. mission. Trump also said U.S. forces had achieved results in the operation that just began, claiming that 7 small fast boats attempting to interfere had been shot down. Other than the South Korean ship, Trump claimed that there had been no other damage reported in the strait. We do know that U.S. War Secretary Pete Hegseth and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Dan Kane are expected to hold a press briefing on the situation and possibly give more information.
And we will be watching closely how this situation continues to unfold. Now, in terms of reactions here in Seoul, we heard an emergency meeting was convened overnight.
Yes, the government convened a meeting around midnight to discuss follow-up measures. According to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that meeting was chaired by Second Vice Foreign Minister Kim Jin-ha and involved 7 Middle East missions, as well as the Ministry of Oceans and Fisheries. During the meeting, Kim expressed deep concern over the incident and noted that it was the first case of damage to a South Korean vessel in the area since the outbreak of the Mideast conflict. He stressed the need to determine what caused the explosion and prevent the recurrence, also maintaining full readiness to protect South Korean crew members. But fortunately, as we know now, no casualties had been reported. The participating mission said they're in close contact with local authorities and taking necessary steps to safeguard and assist South Korean ships and crew. They added that they'll further enhance coordination with host governments to ensure swift rescue operations and the safety of Korean nationals in case of emergencies.
Moving on, today is South Korea's 104th Children's Day. It is a public holiday, and it was wonderful to see so many children and families enjoying the time off together coming into the studio today. Mm-hmm. Now, President Lee Jae-myung and First Lady Kim Hye-kyung held a special event at Cheonghwa Day to help celebrate the day. Rosine, tell us a bit more about that.
Yes. So this event, the first Children's Day celebration to be held back at Cheonghwa-dae following the presidential office's return. And the presidential couple welcomed more than 200 people, including children from depopulating regions, multicultural families, as well as local area residents. Now, children who had previously met the presidential couple during their visits to welfare centers, childcare facilities, and meetings with families of patients with rare diseases across the country also attended this celebration. Participants were said to have toured the main building of the presidential office. They also enjoyed free playtime at Nokjiwon, which is a green space in the presidential compound. It was transformed into a playground for the day. Various hands-on activities and other special programs were also offered.
Well, while the nation celebrates children, we earlier heard from the National Human Rights Commission. They issued a warning about private education and children's rights. What did the commission say?
Yes, Commission Chair An Chang-ho said extreme early private education is a serious violation of children's rights. And he made that remark in a statement which was released before today, Children's Day, citing the results of a UNICEF survey that found out of 36 countries, including members of the OECD and the European Union, South Korea ranked fourth in children's academic skills, very high, but 34th in children's mental health.
And Rosine, what was assessed based on these rankings?
Well, An said the figures demonstrate that South Korean children may be ahead in competition, but don't feel sufficiently safe or stable in their daily lives. He said excessive early learning deprives children of time for play, rest, and self-expression while hampering healthy growth and development. He also stressed that a child's growth must be nurtured by time and being cherished, not by the pace of competition.
Well, hopefully on a day like today, children are out having fun and taking a break from their studies. And that's where we'll wrap up today's news briefing. Rosine, thank you so much for bringing us all the headlines.
Thank you.
South Korea's unemployment figure rose back above 1 million in the first quarter for the first time in 5 years, and young people are bearing a significant share of the burden. According to the latest data, the number of unemployed reached 1,000.029 million between January and March, up 49,000 from a year earlier. Among them, 272,000 were aged 15 to 29, pushing the youth unemployment rate to 7.4%, the highest first quarter level in 5 years. And one factor drawing global attention is artificial intelligence and its impact on jobs in Korea and around the world. To help us unpack it all, we'll speak to Nick Lichtenberg, a business editor at Fortune, to look at how similar concerns are playing out overseas. But first, we're joined by News One economy reporter Shim So-hyun, who has been following the impact of AI on Korea's labor market. Mr. Shim, great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, let's start with the latest employment picture. Mr. Shim, what do the newest job figures tell us about unemployment in Korea, especially among young people?
So the latest numbers show that Korea's labor market is sending somewhat mixed signals. On the surface, the overall market does not look too bad. Korea has continued to add jobs, and some headline indicators such as the employment rate have remained relatively strong. But the picture looks much worse when we focus on young people. The youth unemployment rate was at 7.4%, the highest first quarter level in 5 years. And the number of unemployment people also rose back up 1 million, as you mentioned, and among them, you know, and more than 25% of them were aged between 15 and 29. And young people are becoming increasingly less economically active and increasingly in the labor market, but having trouble getting an entry-level job. And a recent Bank of Korea report points out that this is not just a short-term unemployment issue. It points to a broader problem in how young people enter the labor market. The report says that decline in youth labor market participation is largely explained by increases in young people who are either, quote-unquote, resting or preparing for jobs. In other words, some young people are not simply unemployed. They're delaying their entry into the labor market or staying outside of it altogether. And the report also points to several structural factors. Competition for good jobs has become tougher. Industrial changes have reduced some of the jobs that young workers used to rely on. And the growing population of older adults, along with the spread of AI, appears to be narrowing the entry routes into the labor market. So I would say the latest figures show a youth job market under pressure, while the Bank of Korea report I mentioned suggests that the problem is deeper than one bad quarter. It is becoming a structural issue about how young people get their first real chance in the labor market.
Now, Mr. Shim, you've just briefly mentioned AI, artificial intelligence. What do the latest statistics say about the impact of AI on the job market?
So what's really interesting in the latest Bank of Korea report is that it tries to look at AI not just as a future risk, but as something that may already be showing up in youth employment data. The report looks at industries by their exposure to AI, and in simple terms, industries with a higher share of professional and office jobs tend to have higher AI exposure, while industries that rely more on manual, face-to-face, or physical work tend to have lower exposure. And the finding is quite striking. Around the launch of ChatGPT in November 2022, Korea saw a decline of about 255,000 jobs among people aged 15 to 29 over the past 4 years. And of that decline, about 251,000 jobs were in industries with high exposure to AI. So that means 98.3% of the decline in youth jobs was concentrated in AI-exposed industries. The report also says this is because AI can relatively easily replace the more routine tasks that young workers often perform. So the key point is not that AI is replacing every young worker, but that the pressure seems to be really concentrated in entry-level work, especially in industries where professional and office tasks are more exposed to AI.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in addition to these kind of office tasks and office jobs, there's this growing concern that AI can really reduce entry-level jobs. And these are, you know, especially the kind of positions that young people, I think, really rely on to start their careers. Is that what's already happening in Korea? And how should we kind of understand that situation?
I would put it this way. AI is probably not the whole story behind Korea's youth unemployment issue, but it is becoming harder to ignore. And rather, AI is interacting with problems that were already there. The BOK report points out that young people were already facing a narrower path into the labor market. Competition for good jobs has become tougher. Some industries that used to absorb young workers have weakened. And older workers are staying in employment longer. So AI is not arriving in a perfectly healthy labor market. It is arriving in a market where young people were already finding it difficult to get their first real job. But AI matters because it may directly affect that first step. Entry-level workers often start with relatively standardized tasks. They support senior workers, prepare basic documents, organize data, or do research, or handle routine office tasks. The Bank of Korea report points out that these kinds of tasks are relatively easier for generative AI to replace or support. So the concern is not necessarily that AI is immediately wiping out employment opportunities for young adults across the board. It is more subtle than that. AI may be reducing the need for some of the basic tasks that companies used to give to younger employees. And if those tasks shrink, the problem is not just today's job numbers. The bigger issue is career formation. Young people need those entry-level jobs to build experience, learn how companies work, and move on to better positions later. So I would describe the situation this way. AI may not, again, be the whole story, but it could be weakening the first rung of the career ladder. And that is especially concerning in Korea because that first rung was already becoming harder for young people to reach.
Well, as you said, Mr. Shim, of course, it's still too early to say that, you know, AI is the main driving force of this issue. But it's definitely a problem that we cannot ignore. And of course, it raises a broader question about whether this is mainly a Korea-specific problem or part of a wider shift in the global labour market. Mr. Shim, please stay with us because we are going to come back to you in a moment on how the South Korean government is responding. But first, let's widen the lens and look at how AI is affecting job markets beyond Korea. Joining us now on the line from New York is Nick Lichtenberg, a business editor at Fortune, who has been covering the impact of AI on employment, including concerns over job cuts and the future of entry-level work. Mr. Lichtenberg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on with you.
Now, in one of your recent articles, you wrote that AI is already becoming a measurable drag on the US job market, erasing roughly 16,000 net jobs per month over the past year. Can you walk us through, you know, what that figure means and just how significant it is?
Yes. So I read a lot of investment bank research for work and for fun, too, I have to admit. And this was one that caught my eye. It was by Goldman Sachs economist Elsie Pang looking at the U.S. economy. And they estimated that AI substitution, as they called it, is eliminating about 25,000 jobs per month. And then AI augmentation, where AI makes workers more productive and expands hiring, is adding back about 9,000 jobs, which results in a net negative 16,000. And I can get into the framework there, but the big picture is that minus 25,000 plus 9,000. And that's how they see the economy reacting right now.
And Mr. Lichtenberg, just to clarify, that's in relation to the U.S. job market.
That's correct. That's the U.S. economy.
And what kinds of jobs or job categories, you know, are being affected most clearly so far?
Yeah, so they look at how AI can substitute, taking over a role outright, and where it can augment, handling some tasks and freeing up the human to do more value-added work. And the specific jobs disappearing are sort of routine white-collar and administrative positions such as data entry clerk and junior coder, software assistants, legal support, junior marketing and content roles, customer service representatives, and research assistants. Right. Separate things I've brought into this report were about entry-level U.S. jobs, which have fallen about 35% over the last 18 months, and that seems to support this this theory.
Well, let's talk a bit more about this impact specifically on entry job level seekers, because, you know, here in South Korea, recent data is suggesting that it is those entry level job seekers fresh out of college who are particularly vulnerable to these AI related job losses. Are you seeing a similar pattern in the US, and why are early career workers, you know, it seems particularly exposed?
Yes, we are seeing a similar pattern. Different economists have different ways. There's different Federal Reserve banks here, and I read Torsten Slok of Apollo Global Management, a huge Wall Street voice, and they all see some impact, and they disagree over the nature of it. But roughly double the rate of unemployment for the whole workforce is the recent college graduate unemployment level. And even the IMF, their head, Kristalina Georgieva, she said entry-level workers worldwide are exposed to this. Davos this year, she said it's like a tsunami coming for the global workforce. So she sees a global thing happening here.
So really, really concerning for those entry-level job seekers. One immediate concern is that AI removes entry-level jobs, that if AI removes entry-level jobs, companies may lose the traditional pathway for training the next generation of workers, including people who will eventually need to use and, of course, manage AI systems. You've written about what you call the AI layoff trap. For our listeners, could you explain what that means?
Yeah, so basically this is a sort of paradox. It's sort of a collective action problem where each firm can see that some jobs can be substituted by AI, and so they cut back hiring there, and there's a short-term efficiency advantage. But when everyone does that at the same time, the companies that train the next generation of skilled workers, all those jobs don't exist all of a sudden if everyone's doing it at the same time. So you end up with a bit of an arms race and a race to the bottom where eliminate this pipeline of human talent that they need. They're going to need it to work with AI systems, frankly, in the future. And so the hard skills that middle managers and then senior managers develop early in their careers, that's a real open question because of this AI layoff trap.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, Mr. Lichtenberg, maybe looking ahead, if more young people are continuing to be pushed to the margins of the job market because of what we're seeing with the growth and development of AI, you know, what kinds of solutions should governments or even companies be considering?
Yeah, so this is really interesting because it's sort of unprecedented and you've got some major thought leaders. Our editor-in-chief flew out to California about a month ago and sat down with Vinod Khosla, with the great venture capitalist. And he said, we should rethink the whole tax system because we tax income right now. And if income is going to be, reproduced by these AI substitution patterns, then we should tax different things, maybe universal basic income. And Sam Altman, the OpenAI CEO, has floated similar things. I know Elon Musk has said a lot about this. And so some of the big leaders in tech, it should be noted that they're also the leaders of AI companies who have an incentive to sort of hype the major impact that's happening. But they are saying we need to rethink our taxation system, really our whole kind of social contract, if this technology really takes off this way. And I should say that 16,000 jobs, it could seem like a big number, but out of the entire workforce, that's still on the margins. That's just a couple percentage points. So we're really at the very beginning of this whole wave of disruption.
Mm-hmm. That was Nick Lichtenberg, a business editor at Fortune. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That gives us a really useful sense of how these concerns are playing out in the US and what other governments and companies may need to think about. Let's now bring back Mr. Shim and return to the situation here in South Korea. Mr. Shim, finally, what plans or measures has the South Korean government announced to try and address the impact of AI on the job market?
So first of all, as a general guideline, the BOK says the policy response should not be limited to short-term support for young people. It says that Korea needs to make it easier for young people to enter the labor market, especially as the structure of the job market changes. One recommendation is to strengthen technical education because industrial change and AI adoption are increasing the need for new skills. The report also points to Korea's labor market structure. It says the burden from strong employment protection can end up being shifted to young people who are still outside the labor market. So the BOK really suggests two broader directions. First, Korea needs to adjust excessive rigidity in employment protection for the so-called regular workers, especially in the primary labor market. And second, it should make it easier for non-regular workers to move into regular jobs. That means encouraging companies to invest more in training non-regular workers, that is, non-employees on non permanent contracts and helping workers build skills that can improve their chances of getting permanent contract positions. So the policy message is not simply protect young people from AI. It is more about helping young people enter the labor market despite AI, aging society, and industrial change. And on the other hand, the South Korean government is not really looking at AI only as a labor market risk. It is actually trying to treat AI as a new growth engine for the whole economy. The finance ministry is preparing a broader blueprint for what officials call an AI transformation, or AX. The basic idea is that Korea is facing very serious structural problems, such as low birth rate, rapid aging, and slowing productivity. And the government sees AI as one of the few tools that could help offset those pressures. So this is not just about the science ministry building AI infrastructure or supporting sovereign AI. It is the finance ministry, the finance ministry is also expected to play a major role using fiscal policy, tax incentives, financial support, and regulatory reform to push AI adoption across the economy. From what we understand, the government is looking at roadmaps for three major areas: manufacturing, non-manufacturing services, and the public sector. That would include things like expanding data centers, strengthening power grids, and helping companies actually integrate AI into their business operations. And the reason they are taking this seriously is that the potential economic impact is quite large. Another Bank of Korea report found that if Korea adopts and uses AI effectively, total factor productivity could improve by 1.1 to 3.2%, and GDP could rise by 4.2 to 12.6%. The same report also says that Korea's shrinking labor supply could reduce GDP by 16.5% between 2023 and 2050. But if AI successfully boosts productivity and output, that loss could be narrowed down to about 5.9%. So I think the government's position is basically, yes, AI may disrupt some jobs, especially entry-level jobs. But if Korea moves quickly enough, AI could also become a way to create new industries, raise productivity, and soften the economic hit from demographic decline.
So ultimately, the goal is about quickly adopting and integrating AI to try and, as you said, soften that economic blow. That's where we'll wrap up today's discussion. But of course, we'll continue to follow how AI is affecting employment here in South Korea and around the world. News One economy reporter Shim So-yeon, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights.
Thank you again for having me today.
Across the Middle East, children are once again paying a heavy price for war. It has now been more than 2 months since the US-Israeli attack on Iran, and the conflict has continued to ripple across the region. For children, that means not only the immediate danger of violence, but also disrupted access to food, medical care, education, and basic protection. Humanitarian groups are warning that the impact could last far beyond the fighting itself, through trauma, displacement, malnutrition, family separation, and in some cases, the risk of children being recruited or used by armed groups. Marking Children's Day today, and in lieu of Korea Trending, we will take a closer look at how children in Iran and the wider region are being affected, what rights are at risk, and what kind of support is most urgently needed. To do that, we're joined today on the line by Alexander Sayeh, Head of Humanitarian Policy and Advocacy at Save the Children. Ms. Sayeh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we look at specific risks such as child recruitment and access to aid, let's start with the overall picture. It's been more than 2 months since the US-Israeli attack on Iran. Could you first give us a sense of, you know, just how many children have been affected by the ongoing conflict in the Middle East and how the war is impacting children's rights in Iran and across the wider region?
Well, let me start off by saying that this has been one of the most expansive conflicts that we've ever seen. This conflict impacted several countries where more than 100 million children live. And in places like Iran and in Lebanon, we saw several hundred children killed and many more injured. In terms of how this conflict in Iran, we saw children impacted in multiple ways. We saw direct attacks on civilian areas. We saw attacks on schools, on homes, and we saw, at least in one incident, several hundred school children killed in a single attack. We saw mass casualties and injuries. We saw disruption to services, including water, education, and healthcare. And we saw immense psychological trauma, even where children survived physically from attacks. And we know that many children lost family members displaced, which also had a mental health impact. And across the wider region, we saw a spillover of violence. In places like Lebanon, we saw an escalating Israeli attacks, which caused mass displacement. More than a million people were displaced in a very small country, which included several hundred thousand children who were displaced and forced from their homes. And while the situation escalated in places like Iran and in Lebanon, we also saw deterioration in places like the West Bank, where children were already experiencing extreme levels of violence. What we saw overall is a complete erosion of adherence to international law, erosion of protection norms, and we have growing concerns of further grave violations against children, including recruitment, denial of humanitarian assistance, and attacks on civilian infrastructure.
You've just mentioned a figure of 100 million children at risk across the region. It's an absolutely staggering figure. And you've also mentioned a lot of various risks that these children are facing. You know, when conflict disrupts families, schools and social services, what are children most vulnerable to? What are the biggest protection concerns in this ongoing conflict in the Middle East?
We've seen children exposed to extreme harm, harm that could have lifelong consequences. But what we've also seen is the mental health impact of this conflict, the trauma of seeing loved ones killed, the trauma of seeing your school attacked, the trauma of living in fear, not being able to go to sleep because of fear of airstrikes or bombardment or missiles. And this is one of the trends that we see in complex settings, irrespective of location. It's the mental health impact of war and violence on who are robbed of any sort of sense of safety and security.
Well, in addition to that, you know, very, very serious mental health impact, that trauma that these children are facing, I think that one of the most other serious concerns, protection concerns in any conflict is the possible recruitment or use of children by armed groups. There have been reports that Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, has encouraged children as young as 12 to volunteer as homeland defending combatants. This campaign, of course, has strong international condemnation, with Human Rights Watch saying that the military recruitment and use of children is a grave violation of children's rights and a war crime when the children are under 15. What do we know about these reports, and how concerned are you about the risk of children being drawn into this conflict?
Well, look, reports of children that young being recruited are deeply alarming, and if verified, would constitute a serious violation of international law. In these sorts of contexts, children cannot give meaningful consent, and their recruitment puts them at extreme risk of harm, trauma, and lifelong consequences. in these sorts of situations, the international community must be unequivocal that this must stop. We need sustained pressure, proper monitoring, and that's absolutely critical.
Well, even for children who might not directly be caught up in the fighting itself, the effects of this war could potentially last for years. As this conflict continues with no potential end in sight or no clear end in sight, what could the long-term impact be on children in Iran and the wider region?
In many contexts, including in Lebanon and also in Iran, we saw education systems collapse because of attacks on schools. We are seeing trauma go unaddressed. The psychological trauma cannot be underestimated. Prolonged exposure to violence, displacement, and loss has deep and lasting impacts on children's mental health and their ability to recover and participate fully in society. But what we're most concerned about is the normalization of this level of harm. The number of attacks, the continued attacks on civilian areas, the complete disregard for children's lives and civilian life at large is deeply alarming, as it's become routine to attack civilian areas without any sort of accountability. So we're calling for urgent action to ensure that a definitive ceasefire is in place and that all parties adhere to international law. It will have long-term consequences for children in conflict everywhere.
In addition to those calls, urgent calls for an immediate ceasefire, how is Save the Children helping affected children in the ongoing war in the Middle East? And what kind of urgent support do these children need right now?
So we are working in several countries where one of our biggest programs is in Lebanon. We're also working in the West Bank in Gaza. In Lebanon, we were working in displacement sites where families had fled to. We distributed things like mattresses, food, water. In Gaza, we are also distributing water, medicine, and other essential supplies. We are also providing education services for children. We're providing safe learning spaces for children, spaces where children can be children again, find a sense of normalcy, learn, play. And this is one of the most important things in conflict settings. We are continuing to work around the clock. Our staff, we have hundreds of staff on the ground who are continuing to work in places where children need it most. So that's what we're doing. And children need urgent support, particularly at this moment.
Speaking of that urgent support, we're hearing from some humanitarian groups that this war is disrupting supply chains and delaying access to some of the basic services you've described, things like life-saving care for malnourished children, medicine, clean water, safe shelter. And from Save the Children's perspective, what would you say are the biggest challenges aid organizations face when trying to reach children in these affected areas?
What is so alarming about this conflict is the expansive impact it's having globally on children and the ability to access services. And we have found that with the rise in fuel prices, with the rise in oil prices, this is actually adding extra costs to humanitarian organizations to deliver humanitarian assistance in contexts all over the world. The rise in fuel prices increases the cost of shipping, of fuel, of food, and of medical supplies. Well, we've already seen shipping costs increase by more than 20% in some cases. In places like Sudan, in Somalia, in Yemen, we've seen, and Afghanistan even, we've seen delivery routes completely disrupted, delaying the shipment of medical supplies. And at least 410,000 children at least in Sudan and Afghanistan and Yemen, did not have access to medicine in time because of disruptions to the supply routes. It's going to have a massive impact on the price of commodities, making food less affordable to families and more difficult for organizations like ours to distribute. And we're seeing these consequences across various countries, and with the prices in fuel continuing to rise, we worry that this is going to continue to have an impact on the ability of our organizations to treat things like malnutrition, battle cholera outbreaks, and other challenges.
That really highlights just, you know, how wide-reaching the impact of this conflict is and will continue to be. Finally, for our listeners who may feel concerned but quite far removed from what's happening, what can ordinary people around the world do to help children affected by what's going on in the Middle East and the wider region?
I think the number one thing is awareness. Talk about what's happening, share stories, call on your politicians to demand a ceasefire, to a return to diplomacy, investment in international law. That is what will get us out of this conflict.
Well, thank you so much for helping us to raise awareness. And as we've heard today, the impact of war on children goes so much further than the immediate danger of violence. It affects their health, their education, safety, and their future. Of course, we'll continue to follow the situation in Iran and across the wider region and the urgent efforts to protect children caught in the conflict. Alexander Saye, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing Save the Children's perspective.
Thank you for having me.
Annyeonghaseyo. Hello, everybody. My name is B-Boy Phil Wizard, and I am the breaking gold medalist from the Paris 2024 Olympic Games, and you are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
That time again, Hallyu Highlights, your weekly scoop on everything hot in Korean entertainment, from the latest K-pop hits to the K-dramas everyone's binging. And as usual, we're joined today on the line by our resident K-culture expert, Bernie Cho. Hey Bernie, great to have you with us.
No, it's always good to be back.
Bernie, kicking things off this week, we're looking at a packed May comeback calendar for K-pop girl groups. Maybe by coincidence, maybe it's careful timing. Some of the biggest names from the industry's four major agencies, of course, that's HYBE, SM, JYP, and YG. They're all preparing to release new music in the days and weeks ahead. Break it down for us. Exactly who is releasing this new music?
Oh my goodness. You know, whenever any one of these bands releases something new, whether it's a single, a video, an EP, or an album, it's generally big news. But what makes this news particularly massive, especially in the month of May, where we may have to literally, have the sirens go off and declare Mayday, Mayday. It seems like every day in the month of May, not just a new or emerging, but honestly, superstar acts, you know, whether they be double A, single A, triple A, five-star K-pop girl bands, are all coming out over the next 4 weeks from the big Fab Four companies, as you mentioned, JYP, SM, YG, and HYBE. To sort of kick things off, I believe later today, if not in the next 24 hours, Baby Monster from YG Entertainment is set to roll out their new EP, appropriately titled Choom, which, for those of you who don't know what that means, it means dance. and it's likely going to be a dance club banger. Right now, what we know so far is that it's going to be a four-track EP, and already the founder, Yang Hyun-suk of YG, the YG of YG, has really sort of put himself out there saying, and I quote, "This new album is like unlike anything that Baby Monster has done before." I mean, talk about hype. It doesn't get bigger than that. On top of that, not following up soon after is from JYP. We've got essentially a new album coming out from NMIXX on May 11th called Heavy Serenade. That one I still need to sort of wrap my head around as to what it is. But what makes this particular new release very special is the fact that members of the band, particularly Lily and Bae, actually took part in not only singing but writing the songs themselves. So we're starting to see a transition of girl bands similar to boy bands, where the members are not just performers but singer-songwriters as well. And then we cannot forget that also from JYP, ITZY is slated to drop something new just a few days later on May 18th for Motto. And then last but not least, we have a major release coming from HYBE on May 22nd from Le Sserafim. It's their second LP and it's called Pure Flow Part One. It's a little confusing because it's their second LP. Why it's Part One, I don't know. But nonetheless, it's their first studio album in almost 3 years. It's hard to believe these newbies have been around for 3 years, but in many ways, they're very much veterans of the scene. And this particular album, they are sort of going in a different direction where, and I quote, their tagline is, "For we are not fearless and therefore powerful." Dot, dot, dot. As to what this means, we have to wait and see. And then last but not least from SM Entertainment, on May 29th, they're going to be dropping their second LP as well, aespa, called Lemonade. And this is going to be interesting to see what the concept will be, because aespa always comes out with something very provocative, very visual, and just very out there. And so, in addition to the big four, IOI on May 19th, this is a mouthful. They're coming out with their third EP. And IOI is a girl band, project band that comes from the audition shows, known as the Produce 101 series. And so a lot of big releases coming out over the next few weeks. It's hard to keep up, so we decided to get ahead of this and get in front of this and drop it all at once at the beginning of the month rather than throughout the month.
Right, what an absolutely jam-packed schedule. Fans, mark your calendars. What more could they ask for? But I do want to know, why do you think so many K-pop girl groups are making their comeback this month? Is this some kind of careful planning by agencies to try and kind of spur some competition, or is it just a coincidence?
Well, part of me wants to attribute it to possibly maybe the weather. Usually, when spring comes around, it's always a good excuse to drop a lot of fresh new releases to be in time and in sync with the weather. Part of me thinks that has to do with the month of May being AAPI month here in the United States, the largest market for K-pop. AAPI meaning Asian American Pacific Islander Month. So there's often a lot of heavy promotions for any and all bands that happen to be Asian American, Asian diaspora, so that might be part of it. And another thing we cannot discount is the fact that the World Cup is coming around the corner this summer. And often, when it comes to big events, big festivals, big concerts, big shows, and more importantly, big releases, the World Cup is hard to compete with. And so a lot of companies, a lot of artists, sometimes time their releases to be sometime a little bit before or a little bit after the World Cup, or for that matter, the Olympics, because it is really hard to capture, but more importantly, compete in the attention category with these big major sporting events. So it could be any one of those, part of any one of those, or none of the above reasons. But nonetheless, this particular May really stands out for just having just a bevy of blockbuster releases coming out.
Well, some excellent theories there, Bernie. But as you said, whatever the reason, I'm sure fans are going to be so excited and have a great month ahead to look forward to. And also making waves this week is speculation about JYP's next girl group. after newly discovered trademark filings caught the attention of Super Sleuth K-pop fans online. For fans hunting for clues about upcoming debuts, the Korea Intellectual Property Office database has become this kind of unlikely but really valuable source of hints. Bernie, tell us, what exactly did JYP register?
You know, usually when netizens are looking for the next big thing, the new big act, whether it's a new boy band or girl band, you know, obviously the go-to, and hence the reason why we call them netizens, is they look on the internet. And usually they sort of see hints or drops of hints or suggestions online and social media. But the really hardcore fans, they know where to go. They know where to look. They know exactly what is coming up next. And of all places, they do their sleuth work. And more importantly, their digging and their discovery is, of all places, something as unsexy and as boring as the Korean Intellectual Property Office database, no less. And this has proven to be a very successful and a very accurate method of predicting who's going to come out next, but more importantly, with what name and with what brand name for these new bands. Previously, this is how fans were able to discover the name of NMIX before they debuted. And so for a lot of fans, they're like, you know what? Why don't we go digging again? And lo and behold, on May 1st, not one, not two, but four new trademarks were registered on April 23rd by JYP Entertainment. And of the four, one of them seems to stand out as possibly maybe the name of a new girl band that's slated and scheduled to come out later this year. Now, I got to be very honest and truthful. Some of these names don't roll easy off the tongue. I think they're going to be acquired tastes.
Okay.
But a lot of fans are reverse engineering some of these names. And some of them, unfortunately, to kind of comic effect. But one of the names is called Tiro Miko, which some people are confused as to, is this something to do with tiramisu? Not sure. Capizia, which sounds like cappuccino. Not sure. Cherisha, which I can't even really pronounce properly, but it's spelled in a really unique way. But last but not least, and this is the front runner for the new K-pop girl band name, Drum Machine Roll Please, Crackle. And it sounds like crackle, but it's spelled crackle. And so this one, on a technicality, is the front runner because, and this is something that is really for the hardcore, but this name was registered under Class 41 Entertainment Services from JYP, which usually is where new band names are classified. Capizia, for whatever reason, was listed for Class 18 Bags and Leather Goods, not quite sure. Cherisha, classes 14 and 16, which is accessories and stationery. And last but not least, Tiro Miko, classes 3, 9, and 14 for cosmetics, apps, and accessories. A bit confusing, not quite sure, but I have a feeling netizens are betting right that Kiracle will likely be the new name for the new group that's coming out later this year.
Right. Well, of course, we'll just have to wait and see. But some absolutely incredible investigative journalism from the fans there. And that's where we'll wrap up this week's edition of Hallyu Highlights. A big thank you, as always, to Bernie Cho for guiding us through the biggest stories and buzz in Korean entertainment. Always great to have you with us, Bernie.
Always good to be here.
That's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. Don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. We've got more stories, interviews, and insights you won't want to miss. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thanks for joining me. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in to KBS World Radio. KBS World Radio is Korea's flagship international broadcaster, airing in 11 languages. The English service of KBS World Radio broadcasts news, music shows, and more on various platforms, including shortwave radio and online. Visit our website at world.kbs.co.kr, where you can find the latest news and stream all of our content. We are also available on mobile. To listen to our 24-hour service or our programs wherever you are, download the KBS Kong app or KBS World Radio On Air app onto your smartphone. We also want to hear from you. Visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/ingusKBS and email us at english@kbs.co.kr to let us know your thoughts. Thank you.
KBS World Radio.